Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I'm going to say a few words about this very, very difficult subject, and then I hope that the bulk of it can be discussion together. There's, as you probably know, tomorrow there's a panel. I'm not sure whether that's open to the public or not. It's a recording session. I think it is, or it should be. So I'll be moderating with David Robertson on one side and Wayne Grudem on the other, about the same sorts of things, and they've done a lot of thinking about this, so there's plenty of opportunity here. The rise of gay rights, including now what seems to be the all but inevitable legal support for same-sex marriage in many countries, has the effect of a tidal wave. Better get out of the way or be drowned in obscurity, we're told. Sure, there will be ups and downs, advances and setbacks, but things are moving fast. Two American presidents have changed their mind, or as they put it, evolved on the subject. President Barack Obama, in a very public announcement last spring, declared that his views had changed, followed by his second inaugural address, where he actually called for gay marriage. And former President Bill Clinton recently disavowed the Defense of Marriage Act, known as DOMA, which is something that he had himself signed into law 17 years previously. Linda Hirschman, who's a retired lawyer, has written a compelling story of how gay rights have basically been established. The title, Victory, The Triumphant Gay Revolution, published by Harper, is surely overstated. Yet, we read of the month-by-month advancement of the cause of homosexual as well as bisexual and transgendered people in relationship to marriage. And unless something remarkable happens, or unless we have strong powers of resistance, it's pretty easy to become swept up in this narrative. The narrative. How can we not be swept along by the stories of gay people once terribly maligned and now stepping out of the closet into a more tolerant world? In our own family, we can cite a case, we have several cases, as many of you, maybe most of you do, in point, which tells such a story. Barbara's Uncle John, her mother's brother, is gay. And for years, he and his partner had to live a clandestine life. Everyone sort of knew, but practically no one accepted his circumstance. His own mother never met Lewis, who is his partner, because she could not have abided such an aberrant reality in her view. And now, some 65 years later, into their faithful partnership, they were able to marry under the new Manhattan statute. Right away, a articulate and moving article was written about this couple in New York Magazine, one of the leading publications of the city. And the question that I want to raise is, what can Christians who hold to the so-called traditional view of marriage say in these circumstances? Or to put it differently, is there a counter-narrative that is as forceful or more so than that of the triumphal gay revolution? I believe we do, but I believe in order to offer it, we need to know a few of the facts of where we are. Now, each country is different. Great Britain has not finalized homosexual marriage. It's going to be in the House of Lords. In the United States, it's done state by state, on a state by state basis. In France, it's a fait accompli, although Sunday they had one of the largest demonstrations on record of people opposing what had been legislated. In the 1950s, in most countries, being gay was a crime. Barbara was partly brought up by a wonderful Swiss governess in Lucerne, and she never married. She lived with her brother, and only after years of knowing her very, very well, were we told that he was gay, and that somebody had blackmailed him. And fortunately, he wasn't accused, because had he been inculpated, he would have spent most of the rest of his time in jail, in a Swiss jail in Lucerne. And he was able to hide, get out under the radar. But it was a crime. In many countries, the crime is associated with sodomy, and so on. Moving through the revolutionary 60s, people began to change, be more accepting, tout the virtue of freedom above all others, including freedom in the sexual revolution. Then in the 70s, we had a series of interesting lawsuits. Now, I'm not going to bring the legal aspects of this to the fore. I'm not capable of it, and it's not my main purpose. But there were some sort of landmark lawsuits against gay people, which many of which went towards their exoneration. In the 1980s, people began to change their awareness along with the lawsuits. When I was a school teacher in Greenwich, Connecticut, my closest friend and colleague, we taught French together, was a dear man who comes from Aix-en-Provence, where we spent much of our life. And he, within a few weeks of our friendship, confessed that he was gay. And he said, "I know this is wrong. I know the Bible calls it a sin, but this is what I'm driven by, and I need to recognize that, or I will condemn myself to not just a double life, but to a deadly frustration and conflict. And so I've chosen to live more or less underground, and we make our life together." And then in the 80s, a lot of awareness started to change. The school for which I worked, which was not a Christian school, was what Americans call private school, boys' school, actually moved to accept and even affirm sexual preference, as it was called, in their hiring practice. And they were very foresighted. They bought up a lot of real estate in Greenwich, Connecticut, which is the gilded edge of the East Coast, because it's a bedroom community for New York City, very, very wealthy. So property is expensive. Well, they bought up a lot of housing, and for their teachers, including a house for my friend and his partner. And should you be critical of this, you had better pretty much go underground, because it was unacceptable, less and less acceptable. As you know, in the 90s, more and more people, quote, came out of the closet. Perhaps the most poignant case of this for me I was a student at Harvard University, and I'm a pretty loyal alumnus. And so I keep in touch with it. Not only that, but I sang in the choir at the Memorial Church, and I was very close to all the activities of the Memorial Church. The pastor of Memorial Church, in the years after I graduated until 2 years ago, was Peter Gomes, a fascinating character, a pretty much evangelical small e / neo-orthodox pastor, which was a very healthy contrast to his predecessor, who was just a wide-eyed liberal. Unusual in that he was an African-American conservative in politics. He was head of the Plymouth Rock Society, which is where the Mayflower landed, black guy. And I remember we were, in Harvard Yard, and there was Peter Gomes holding something under his coat, his overcoat, and he was kind of running across the yard, and we stopped him and said, what are you doing? Why are you running? And he opened up his coat, and it was a bottle of champagne, and he said, someone has to celebrate Maggie Thatcher's victory here. No one else will. I will. Just unusual kind of character. Well, in the early 90s, there was a student, I guess not demonstration, but a kind of a manifestation, which had published a rather thoughtful magazine about the issue of homosexuality. And the articles were, I thought, quite deeply and thoughtfully critical. There was a theologian, there was a psychologist, there was a sociologist, there was some students and so forth, but in a loving sort of pastoral way. In the middle of this whole thing, Peter Gomes came out of his church and stood on the platform and decided to tell the world that he was gay. So this is one of the most dramatic cases of a coming out of the closet. And a good friend and somebody we had hitherto admired. And then he did a rather curious thing. He started to criticize the evangelical church for its attitudes. As far as anyone knows, the evangelical church had rather treated him well and wasn't all that interested in his homosexuality, though, maybe gently critical of it. But he was very, very sure that the church had been the source of so many of his problems. So many of us got really disappointed. He continued to be a great preacher. He's written books about the Bible and so forth. And but he came out. And this coming out occurred more and more. President Clinton allowed it for gays in the military, but it was his don't ask, don't tell policy. And then the military has now reversed itself. In the years of the beginning of the new millennium and into last year and now today, increasingly there has been pushback and the legalization of marriage in many states with this feeling of sort of inevitability that I mentioned at the beginning. And as I said at the beginning too, one feels the weight of this narrative. We lived a double life. We were oppressed. Nobody understood us. It was illegal. And now we can come out. And this is associated with the argument for marriage. And so what are the facts? It's actually quite interesting that in many, many countries where I've looked at the statistics, the number of self-avowed practicing gays is actually astonishingly small. In all of the surveys that I looked at, including a Pew survey for the United States, only 3.5 to 4% who took the survey declared themselves openly practicing gay. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that that's the only number. There's probably indeed many more, and some probably still wouldn't want to fill out the form and avow who they are. In France, it's the same, And in Great Britain, it's the same. The numbers are remarkably small. And yet the lobbies, if I can put it this way, are astonishingly strong. That's not the only case of a minority group that has a much stronger voice than their numbers would suggest. There are many lobbies who are small but vocal and successful. But the impression you might get from listening to many in the media or watching the lobbyists work is that there's a lot of them out there, just a huge number, and it would be absurd to hold them back in some way. The facts are otherwise. Now, the surveys also track who is sympathetic. Of course, a lot more will sign this rubric. Besides, it's very difficult to know what is meant by being sympathetic. Are you sympathetic to the cause of someone who is an oppressed minority? Well, very few people would have to deny that. Are you sympathetic to the issue of having same-sex attraction, which could lead to problems? I think a lot of people would be sympathetic to this issue. Are you sympathetic to practicing same-sex relations or marriage? Of course, then the numbers go down, but they're still far greater than just those who avow themselves to be practicing. When high-profile sympathizers come out, it's very hard to speak against the narrative. One of the astonishing indications or metaphors, I think, for this narrative is the HIV/AIDS drama pandemic. Though known about vaguely in the 70s, it only became really well known in the 80s and beyond. And at least in the States, where we've been living since 1989, it wasn't long before there was a polemic between those who were considered to have a pretty simplistic answer to HIV/AIDS. Their simplistic answer was faithfulness. No medical advances had allowed for the curtailing, let alone the cure of this. There's some progress now. There's still no cure out there. But between them and those who said that gay rights are at stake, and this is a polemic against gay people, because in the beginning, so many people that did contract it were gay. Now, of course, it goes way beyond those borders. But it was an interesting kind of case study where the AIDS pandemic was seen as a huge oppression and problem, the solution to which is certainly not to change your lifestyle, certainly not to ask you to reconsider things like faithfulness, but if to practice safe sex. Just a parenthesis here, I think it's instructive. In the 50s and 60s, when people like Hugh Hefner were inviting the world to hedonism, to the Playboy philosophy, basically something like, have fun, and if anything happens, we have technology. And that changed dramatically when the AIDS pandemic came along, because suddenly there was nothing you could do about it with technology or drugs. My brother, a few years ago, was at a dinner party where they played the grandmother game. I didn't know, you probably don't know, and I asked him, what's the grandmother game? Well, the grandmother game consisted of going around the table and asking, if your grandmother were still alive, I mean, this is people our age, what would she be surprised about today? You know, what could have shocked her? And somebody answered, emails. And they said, no, she had the telephone, and you don't have to extend it too far to imagine things like emails. And somebody suggested, you know, space travel and so forth. You know what the winner was? My grandmother would never have imagined that science plus money couldn't resolve the HIV/AIDS pandemic. That's just a given in the West. And that would have totally shocked her. And yet, with that in mind, the answer is still, don't question faithfulness, don't question the gay lifestyle, practice safe sex. So we've gone from an invitation to have fun to having sex without killing the other person. That's the way I interpret safe sex. You can do it, but here's how you want to do it so you don't have to kill the other person. This is a classic case of idolatry, isn't it? If your idol fails you, you know, don't give up the idol. Worship him harder. So what can Christians who hold to a more traditional view of marriage, a biblical view, say in these circumstances? Do we have a counter narrative that is fourfold? Where is it? While I value enormously the natural law approach, I don't believe it tells enough of a story. There is possibly no better defense of marriage from a natural law point of view today than the triple authors Gerges, Anderson, and George. It's in your bibliography here. What is Marriage? It's published by Encounter Books. The book compellingly argues for what they call comprehensive union, the full union of mind and body in a heterosexual marriage bond. And the core of their argument is that marriage must be based on what they call organic bodily union. Whereas all kinds of friendships can occur, whether among people of the same sex or not, quote, two men, two women, and larger groups cannot achieve organic bodily union. There's no bodily good or function towards which their bodies can coordinate. The authors are fully aware that some couples cannot conceive children, but they argue that infertile couples can establish, quote, a comprehensive mind and body union that would be completed by and apt for procreation and domestic life that thus inherently calls for permanent and exclusive commitment. In other words, whether you can have children or not, the fact that it's meant to have children means you can be committed in the same kind of relationship that people who have children do. It's permanent and exclusive. They further argue or claim that heterosexual marriage is the best way to steer a culture clear of seeing different types of unions as a choice or a preference based on emotion or cohabitation. It's the best place for the children's well-being. It elevates the value of friendship, since marriage doesn't compete with friendship. Nor is it just a higher degree of friendship. It's something different. And then also at stake are religious liberty, because of the dangers of overbearing government and challenging the social good. The book thoughtfully cites an announcement in the New York Times, which explains that Mary and Joe got married, and then in the detail it says, true, they were married to someone else when they met and fell in love, but they felt they ought to get married because they were far more in love with this new friend than they were with their former spouse. And everybody's meant to accept this and understand it. If you're deeply in love, you get married. And they go on to argue that a lot of the arguments for homosexual marriages are, well, they're deeply in love. Now, here we have a pure natural law type of argument. The introduction to the book announces that the authors will make no appeal to divine revelation or religious authority. Now, they're no doubt trying to reach out to their readership on presumably neutral grounds. But it seems to me, and we can discuss this, of course, that they have in the process left out the chief reason to define marriage as heterosexual. It's not natural law of the capacity to have children, though valuable though that might be, but it's that the Word of God institutes marriage. While the many aspects of their arguments are compatible with biblical understanding, they will lack the full force they could have, since they gag themselves from appealing to the Creator of the world and His intentions. The authors say that they're not going to comment on the morality or immorality of homosexuality, choosing to bracket that issue for the sake of simplicity. But I ask, is it really possible to conduct an argument for heterosexual marriage without some comment on the ethics of its competitor, gay marriage? The Apostle Paul has no such qualms, naming homosexual practice as, quote, a dishonorable passion in Romans 1:26. And that's not all the Bible says about homosexuality. No matter how many hermeneutical gymnastics you engage in, it's not possible to skirt such words. In two of his lists of those disqualified for the kingdom of God, Paul includes arsenokoites, or same-sex acts, 1 Corinthians 6:9, 1 Timothy 1:10. Now, Peter Gomes, who I mentioned before, shortly after he came out with a kind of commentary on the Bible as a whole called the Good Book. And when he came to this passage in Romans 1, he suggested that Paul was not condemning homosexual marriage. He was condemning anyone that would leave his or her natural inclinations and go the other way. So he would be just as condemnatory of a heterosexual marriage practiced by gay people. I have read this text over and over again. I can't find any evidence of this interpretation there. It's so clearly a metaphor as well as a reality for what's gone wrong with our society. Men and women who follow passions for each other, it's a sign of great decadence. Now, of course, individual verses that condemn homosexuality are not in themselves likely to persuade a generation which loves the story of liberation from oppression. Rightly so. That's the story we told last night. They're there, and you have to deal with them. But is there a better way to persuade? A few arguments that are good as far as they go are ultimately not good enough, in my opinion. For example, as I mentioned, the recent polls show that only a small number of practicing gays are in the United States and similarly in other countries. The figures vary and so forth, but the discrepancy between the rhetoric and the actual facts, though astonishing, does not make the argument invalid. Indeed, some of us at times can sound paranoid when we accuse the gay lobby of having more power than it should. I'm not saying that it doesn't, and I'm not saying that we're wrong. I am saying there's the danger of being paranoid. Now, of course, also the voice is strongest in certain pockets, media, academe, and other places of influence. Another good but not good enough approach is the finding by many ministry groups that most gay people are not very happy. Such endeavors as Harvest or Exodus have found that gay people are guilt-ridden, lonely, and need relief. This is helpful to know. There should be no surprise if God's intention for sexual union are for two people of the opposite sex to marry. Attempts at sexual fulfillment outside of that framework, gay or not, will often be unhappy. But again, this observation is of limited value. First, because many heterosexuals are also guilt-ridden and unhappy and lonely. Marriage, let's admit it, is not a panacea. It comes with many challenges and conditions. Second, if all we have to go on is an unhappiness index, then we could fix all kinds of things to produce happiness. Behavior modification, rushing gaze into heterosexual marriage, and other potential disasters. Testimonies help. One of the most compelling I've read in recent years, it's in your bibliography, and a lot of you have read it, is The Secret Thoughts of an Unlikely Convert by an unlikely named person, Rosaria Champagne Butterfield. I won't spoil it for you if you haven't read it, but it's the story of an English professor, a lesbian, being loved into the kingdom by kind and patient Christians who took her seriously and listened to her aspirations and worries while showing her the beauties of the Christian faith. In her testimony, there's plenty of theology, good sound theology, and healthy criticisms of the evangelicals that she loves and the community she belongs to. Good testimonies are of great value. But I believe the very best counter-narrative to gay liberation is the biblical worldview, in which heterosexual, monogamous marriage is considered one of God's most precious gifts. Now, let me just say in parenthesis, believing this, having this as one's position, does not lead to a simple equation, here's how you defend it in public. We can get to that. But it's the same in apologetics. I believe that God is there and that he has sent his son to die and to be raised up for sinners because the Bible tells me so. But that doesn't mean in every argument I whip out, you know, the lightsaber of the Bible. It's a, it can be a showstopper. It can be very appropriate. Nothing wrong with quoting the Bible. And in some countries and some cultures, that's not only acceptable, but required. So I'm just saying, let's not make the equation between position and strategy. They're related, but they're two different things. But looking closely at the account of pre-fallen mankind in Genesis 1 to 2, we find something like a celebration of the romance of marriage. Marriage is God's solution for loneliness, for one thing. After his death-like anesthesia, Adam awoke to behold his gorgeous vis-a-vis. He was delighted, Genesis 2:23. To be sure, procreation and populating the earth are a part of the larger picture of marriage embedded in that text. The family, then, is a fundamental unit for human society. But there's far more to marriage than sexual union and offspring. There's the beauty of the ultimate friendship between one man and one woman. This is sometimes called covenant companionship, as the two are aligned in several places in the Bible. It is a legally binding covenant solemnized by public services, vows, and witnesses, but it's a friendship, it's a companionship. And heterosexual marriages go wrong when the legal part is intact, but the friendship part is finished. They go wrong when the friendship part is there, but the commitment is gone. You need both. The Song of Solomon gives an idea about the loveliness of the special attraction between a man and a woman. And even in a fallen world, which is yet being redeemed, marriage symbolizes the union between Christ and his church, according to Paul. Just as a man pursues his mate, taking vows, holding her tight, providing for her, and sacrificing for her, so Jesus pursues the lost, embraces them, and brings them to heaven, all because of his sacrifice at Calvary. And just as his church responds with gratitude and the empty hands of faith. So the spouse responds in mutual love. Some, but I think very little of this, can be reproduced in a gay relationship. Certainly there can be love. There can be sacrifice and friendship. Our uncle is a very good case in point of that. You find few heterosexual friends or partners or married people with the loyalty, the sacrifice, and the friendship that's there. But it's the very difference between the two genders, male and female, each made after God's image, yet in their own distinctive way, that makes for the high complement of the opposite, a place where truly the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. This is not to say that marriage is for everyone. There's a high and noble place for the celibate life, approved by Paul to the Corinthians in the crisis situation. And while it is true that the Reformation did much to dismantle a largely celibate culture and restore the family, it would be equally important to say marriage and family are not the only plan that God has for everyone. And there's that awful pressure in some groups, churches, you know, to kind of meet your spouse in certain circumstances and to sort of wink at the fact that everyone knows that the reason you go to these groups is not to learn from the Bible, but is to meet your spouse. Terrible, terrible pressure. But having said that, surely one of the reasons why gay unions are considered dishonorable in Scripture is because there's not much honor in reaching out to someone who is just like me. Jesus remarked that if you love those that love you, what reward do you have? Now, many questions will follow such simple proposal. One of the most important is social justice for all people, regardless of their background or indeed of their sexual orientation. If marriage is not, strictly speaking, a right, and I believe not strictly a civil right, though I think the civil government needs to recognize it, but instead is a creation ordinance, what of the civil rights of gay people? Christians ought to be just as zealous to safeguard the rights of gay people as we are to safeguard marriage for monogamous heterosexuals. Not because they are gay, but because they're people, citizens, image bearers. And they have been oppressed. And we should lead the charge in putting an end to that. So legislators need to figure out the most equitable way to ensure every citizen be given the proper access to social benefits, retirement, inheritance, and so forth. And not being one, I don't know what that would always look like. I know the woman who helped bring up Barbara, her governess, was always complaining to us that the government gave more rights to married people than even to a brother and sister that lived together. I believe that's changed in Switzerland, but seems to be an injustice. And surely there's much repentance, much repenting to be done over attitudes towards gay people, ones that are hateful and prejudiced. I went to a boarding school many, many years ago where the only view of gay people was yuck. And surely, though, there were young men there struggling with their sexual identity and in need of compassionate counseling. It wasn't going to come from teenage jocks whose only thought was a completely false view of what girls were. So that has to change, and it has changed. It is changing. Many of us are recovering homophobes and gay bashers. I never bash any gays, but just recovering from the yuck factor. Furthermore, those of us who are married heterosexually have a good deal of homework to be done in our own families. It won't do to criticize gays as unhappy and guilty and so forth if our own marriages are flagging. And then I think the church needs to think through what it means to be heterosexual and what it means to be celibate and what it means to be gay and struggling with one's sexuality. While I do oppose rushing into a heterosexual marriage for all gay people, I do think the church has to provide alternatives for those who are so inclined. This legitimate calling of celibacy has also been maligned by sub-Christian attitudes. In many churches, you know, you have couples groups, at least implicitly, where celibate people don't feel at home. What's wrong with this picture? So, at the end of the day, here's my proposal. We do not recommend heterosexual marriage because it works best, because children may be born, or because it's the traditional view. We recommend it because God has ordained it, and it's a good thing. Hebrews 13:1, let marriage be held in honor among all. From that conviction, I think, we then have to work hard on persuasion. And I'll finish with this. One of the areas of persuasion that I think we need to do some work on is being careful that not all cases of oppressed people being liberated are exactly parallel. Barbara and I work a lot with African Americans. Our band is a mixed band, and I preach in African American churches. We have plenty of black students in our seminary. Most of them don't like it when gay people say, our fight is the same fight that you had from slavery and emancipation and then in the 60s with civil rights. Black people resent having their fight being paralleled so closely to the fight for recognition as a homosexual. Part of that is because black people in America are among the most conservative Americans. Not all. Of course, you have liberal ones. But who would have a very high view of heterosexual marriage. And part of it is because civil rights for black people has been such a unique journey, fraught with so much difficulty, weight, as well as wonderful liberty and fruit, that they don't want that to be borrowed by other narratives. So there might be parallels, but I think on the whole, a lot of these are not accurate. We've just got to get our narratives of emancipation straight here. So I hope these thoughts are challenging for you. I know one of the biggest problems is while the natural law argument seems easier because it uses natural ground and a neutral ground seemingly, and there's a lot there, I do think the ultimate reason for believing in heterosexual marriage and for not accepting gay marriage is because God has instituted it from the beginning, and it's the greatest human romance there could be. How do you argue from there? That's another matter. Okay, we've got some time. It's over to you now, and I'd love to hear your thoughts. I'd also, I'd love to hear stories of your own experience and where this can be helpful to the rest of us. It's not quite uncharted territory, but it's so new and it's come so fast. I think a lot, we need each other's help in this. So, yeah, it's remarkably widespread. That's the case that triggered the enormous change in the American Episcopal Church. The New Hampshire bishop left his family for a man. And there was one of the greatest preachers in the UK, this is years ago now, but did the same thing. I don't think anything's beyond redemption, but I do think that this is as condemnable as anything, because not only have you broken your covenant and left your children, not only have you gone for somebody with the same sex, but often the justification is something like, but we really love each other, and there was no love in the former condition. In the case of one minister I know who did this, he said, I have never felt closer to Jesus than when I finally followed my heart. I don't know what verse that comes from. I don't see it in my Bible, but it's the idea that my inclinations, my desires, my need for comfort and freedom trumps every other value. That's why I commented earlier that this book, which is a very fine book, when it says we're not going to get into morality, I think is missing a huge dimension of this, because it's all about morality. And there are plenty of heterosexual couples who are not particularly happily married, but because of the covenant, they stick with it. Some of them happily go and get help, and sometimes the help is helpful. Some of them never do, but God commends anyone who stays in a covenant relationship which has been promised through thick and thin, through the difficulties. You know, I've done a lot of weddings, and the traditional vows, I've come to believe, are extraordinary, you know, in sickness and in health, and for richer, for poorer, until death do us part. They are neither romantic, or in the sense of sentimental romantic, nor are they cynical. They're not sentimental because there's going to be hardship, there's going to be sickness, there's going to be, you know, for a lot of, most of us, poverty, things just get thrown at us, you know, children, something goes wrong. We all know these things. And the vow says, unsentimentally, you're going to go through this together. Now, it's all by the grace of God. Nothing would be possible at all without that premise, of course. But nor is it cynical. It's not saying, you know, stuff happens, so, you know, grin and bear it. Some people make it, some people don't. It's a very noble vow, which says our love, which is a covenant love, which is energized and made possible by the undergirding of the love of Jesus Christ, who died and was raised for us, that is going to endure beyond all trials. On her wedding band, we decided when we got married, Barbara put the Song of Solomon 8:6, which says, love is stronger than death. And most marriages have some sort of death experience, and then we eventually do die. And the love of God, as it sustains us, is stronger than death. And so these friends, I agree with you, it's absolutely tragic. It's more than tragic, it makes you angry. How much do I think scientific research should go into natural law relationships to understand the gay issue? I think the more scientific research, the better. However, having sat through an apologetics session yesterday and a very friendly and healthy debate on two different versions of how God gave us from creation to the present diversity, the relationships between, you know, evolutionary past and the present and so forth, both of them said, just know that scientific research, just like any research, often has an agenda. So it's got to be honest. Yes, with C.S. Lewis, go where the argument leads you. Absolutely. But just be aware that these issues are fraught with the temptation to say, see, science usually proves my view, you know, not other people's views. I'll give you, I don't know if this is helpful, I'll give you an example of how such a research, I think, has helped me a little bit, if it's right, if it's true. You know, years ago, many behavioral psychologists were telling us that being gay is a choice. It's learned behavior. And so that made it, and Christians liked that because it sounded like it was culpable choice, sin. But there was compelling evidence coming on that it was not always the case that it was learned behavior. There can be innate inclinations. I don't know about the genetic evidence. I'm not a geneticist by any stretch. And whether or not that can be, you can show a gay gene or something. But if you could, it would still fit my theology of the fall. Because I think fallen man has inherited all kinds of inclinations, which are, some are good, some are not good. And so having an inclination does not make it justifiable. And now I'm, so that was research that kind of helped me confirm, you know, my view of the fall. And then recently, a lot of gay advocates are coming out and saying, but we want it to be learned, and we want it to be a matter of choice. We don't want to be driven by our biology, because we're free, you know? So interesting how the tables are kind of turned. But to answer your question, I think as much research as possible is a good thing, as long as it's, you know, fair. Yeah. I think that's a really good question, a very good insight as well along the way. If you just make a little semantic switch, I think we can be okay. Take away the word law and substitute the word revelation. Natural revelation is God speaking through the order of things, through history, through the creation, and it is in great tandem with special revelation. In fact, the two require each other. Ten Commandments tell me not to steal, but I don't know what possessions are unless I have natural revelation. So I think what I object to in this book is not so much the idea that nature teaches us things, which of course it does, but that we'd better stay away from anything deeper or more transcendental that sounds like the jaw of religion, or we won't persuade people in the public place. I think we can be persuasive in the public place if we're tactful, if we're wise, if we're smart. So, you know, the best apologetics that I love doesn't thump people with the Bible, but it's not ashamed to interface biblical revelation with general revelation. You know, G.K. Chesterton, he does this with his use of paradox. And actually, he uses the expression the romance of orthodoxy. And he says, you know, that cashiers, I guess, is that an accountant, Peter? What's a cashier? He says that they're the ones who are going to have problems. They're the ones who are going to go crazy. Poets don't go crazy. Now, this is ridiculous, of course. But he's trying to make the point that we typically think people with the facts and a scientific bent, they're the ones who are going to get to the truth. And he says, well, it's people who love true stories and romance that are going to get to the truth. And then he presents Christianity as the best romance going. It's limited, but it's I think extremely valuable. So he uses a natural revelation kind of argument, which I find very different from that hard core natural law. Because, you know, you could use laws in all kinds of ways to prove all kinds of things, you know, very contradictory things. And so my objection is that they just wanted to bracket any use of higher principles or morals to get their point across. I don't think you need to do that. Okay, that's fascinating. Just for some decoding here, Van Til was a revolutionary Christian apologist who brought us back to the need for a transcendental critique. The word presuppositionalism was coined not by him. He didn't like the word much. But it means you should not be ashamed of presupposing God's authority in all things. And he was a strong advocate of natural revelation, but also in tandem with biblical rule. Proposition 8 was the move in California to legalize gay marriage, and it was defeated, right?
No, tell me.
The Marriage Protection, right. Marriage Protection Act, right. Yeah, that was a interesting episode in American history. A lot of the people who voted to protect marriage were minorities, Hispanics, African Americans, and some of them woke up to find their storefronts bashed in, their houses burned, and so forth. by a so-called more tolerant gay community. Now, my friends who are gay would resent my saying the gay community, because they would never stand for that kind of procedure. But the question is generally about remarriage, but how does it apply in the case of gay relations? This is a huge area. I used to teach the ethics course at the seminary where I am, and we spent about a month on marriage, divorce, remarriage. And to make a very long and rich and fascinating story short, the general historic position of at least the Protestant Church has been there are two grounds for legitimate divorce. They don't oblige divorce, but they legitimize it. The one is what you mentioned, adultery, and a couple of synoptics. It is said that except for, it's called the exceptive clause. The word is not the usual one for adultery. It's the word porneia, from which we get pornography. So it might have a broader implication than simply a man going and sleeping with somebody else's wife. But it's sexual infidelity is what is involved. The other one, most of the confessions call it desertion. And it's based on 1 Corinthians 7, where Paul says that if you're married and one of you is not a believer, so this is a situation beyond what the Gospels would have known, and the unbelieving person is not happy with the marriage, the believing person is not bound. Again, a lot of exegesis I would have to do. The question is, and this is where your question is going, and it's a really good one. I sure don't have all the answers, but is that can you extend desertion to include such things as abuse, abandonment, prison? And I think you'd have to consider whether remarriage in those cases could be authorized. And the reason I think the Bible doesn't give you a lot of casuistry on it is because I think such decisions belong to the church, the eldership, the counselors, the professionals, the friends, and so forth. In other words, you know, what's the difference between a husband who is verbally abusive and then changes and he seems to be okay, and a husband who can't stop? Does one justify divorce and the other not? I don't know that you can give a textbook answer for each case. Is the eunuch that Jesus is talking about somebody who struggles with homosexuality and just has decided he's not going to practice, or she? I wouldn't rule that out. I can't say that he was primarily thinking of gay people, but it's interesting he doesn't explain in detail what this means. It's just somebody incapable of heterosexual love, heterosexual practice. And so why not? That could be one of the reasons, and it could be a reason to lead you to stay continent, even though you have inclinations. Anyway, the two basic reasons that are the most often given, and I think they're faithful to Scripture, for legitimate divorce are adultery and desertion. Now, we can get into debates on that. There's a lot of disagreement about it. And therefore, in both cases, remarriage is legitimate and sometimes even warranted. But that's where the community has to come in and help get alongside people and not just get the rule book out. Absolutely. I see that deception, self-deception, is a huge integral part of what the fall has proffered, and particularly of what Paul is talking about in Romans 1. Now, as you suggest, it gets tricky because Romans 1 also says that all people know God, not just about him, not just some vague sense that there's something up there, but they actually know God, yet they process that knowledge wrong. So there isn't a person on earth who doesn't have at some level the tension between knowing God and then building ways that are self-deceptive to walk away from them. Even people with seared consciences, I don't believe, are entirely, absolutely without conscience. They'd have to be devils. So how do you work with people like this? Well, the final persuader, of course, is the Holy Spirit. And without him, no one would be persuaded. But we can help by trying to find the place of tension where there is that deception going on, because people deep down know God. And sometimes the best way, at least in apologetics, is by looking at parallels in other parts of someone's life, which isn't maybe as much of a hot button right now, but where they can at least see the deception going on. Simple example would be Nathan coming to David. David had sinned 3 times, adultery, killed off the husband, lied to his troops. And as a potentate in the Near East, he probably was sitting saying, well, this is kind of my right. And he was, you know, was highly deceived. And instead of the prophet coming to him and saying, you know, let me tell you about your 3 sins, David, which for which he would have gotten thrown out of the court or worse, he told the story, as you know, of the rich man who had lots of a big sheepfold and the poor man who had 1 ewe lamb that he carried around. And the rich man could think of nothing better to throw a party for his friends than to take the guy's ewe lamb. That incensed David. And that was the door open for Nathan to say, you're this guy. So that was the door to his, you know, conscience attack. Doesn't always happen. There are people who will go to the grave without that jolt, without that awakening. But everybody has these 2 forces working within them. A consciousness of God that's insistent. A bit like, you know, the beach ball that you're pushing down in the ocean and it keeps popping up at you. It's just not going to go away. But you still try to push it down. You try to suppress it. So, I believe this discussion is a lot about deception, but no deception is final until we go to the grave.